So welcome to another morning of Q&A. Apparently the questions and answers are going really well, because it means that many people don't need to come to the interviews, simply because they can write the questions down, and the problems which they experience in meditation can be shared with everybody else anonymously. So the questions you ask are asked and the answers given to everybody, which is really nice, to be able to share the answers rather than just have the answers given individually during the interviews. So, first question here. This is an interesting one, about interviews. So, could your kapya sit further away during interviews, as some of the things discussed are quite personal in nature? That is important as the rule as a monk, that I do actually keep that kapya within hearing distance, because you're supposed to be able to hear what's being said. The reason is, because of like monks being celibate, that you have to not just be celibate, but seem to be celibate. And as such, any conversations should actually be at least overheard by the kapya or by another monk. That actually protects the monk and also protects the other person from any possibilities of malicious gossip. You have to do that, because otherwise there are always some people who for one reason or another have malice towards you. And you say even the Buddha was accused a couple of times by his enemies for breaking his precepts. I think many of you know that those couple of occasions, once there was Chincha, and she accused the Buddha of making her pregnant. And she put a pillow under her robe. And I think many of you know that story, and they accused the Buddha in public. Now, he's the father of my child. And of course, because of the Buddha's great parameters, a little mouse crawled up the back of Chincha and cut through the little straps, and that, I think it was actually a piece of wood, and the wood fell on the lady's feet, and thereby the people knew that she was only pretending. But the point is that whenever there's any accusations, sometimes, as I said, when you sling mud, some of it always sticks. So especially in positions of like being a monk or a senior monk, you've got to be very, very careful with those rules. Because otherwise that people would always say, hey, yeah, you know, it's always that same old yogi goes to see Ajahn Brahm every time, and she talks and talks and no one hears what they're saying. And sooner or later, you know, that people would actually start to doubt. But please, those people, if you have anything personal to say, don't be afraid of bringing it up, because anyone who's a gapya is actually sworn to secrecy. So they never actually share what is being said when there's a gapya during interview time. So please, you can actually open up and say what you feel. The gapya will not take it any further. And they won't repeat it even to their closest of friends. Neither will I. So whatever is said is always said in confidence. We have to keep the gapya there just to protect the good name of the Sangha. There's always some malicious people. And this was one of the rules of the Buddha. And obviously at first I thought, you don't really need those rules in the West these days, but now I've been a monk for so long, I see those rules are really important. here we go. You said that the Buddha did not teach Abhidharma, but we read that the Buddha taught Abhidharma to devas in the Tower Tings of Heaven. If this is true, does it mean we human beings don't need to study the Abhidharma? Thank you, Ajahn. If you actually look in the suttas, there's no place at all where the Buddha went to the Tower Tings of Heaven to teach the Abhidharma. In fact, actually, there's a contradiction. That's actually a story. It comes from the commentaries written after the time of the Buddha. So it's actually fascinating for, if you're a Buddhist and you like to investigate these things, read it out for yourself. So you can actually read the original teachings of the Buddha in the suttas, in the Sutta Pitaka. And then afterwards, it was at least 1,000 years later when Buddha Gosa wrote his commentaries on the suttas and on the Vinaya. And at first when I my first studies of Buddhism were on the Vinaya, because being Western monks, some of the understanding of the rules which we had was very, very uncertain. And so I made it my job actually to research that and learn Pali. When I actually started reading, there's actually a lot of difference between the commentaries and the original suttas. As there would be, you know, with 1,000 years of difference. So these days, like many other rational monks, we take the original teachings of the Buddhas in the suttas. That's our basis. And if it's actually in those suttas, we think, yeah, that's Buddhism. If it's what is in the commentaries, we can understand it's added a little bit. So first of all, the Buddha, it does actually say in the commentaries, the Buddha went up to the Tower Tingsa heaven to teach his mother. It also says in the suttas, his mother never went to the Tower Tingsa heaven, she went to the Tusita heaven. So there's a bit of an inconsistency there anyway, that his mother was in the Tusita, not the Tower Tingsa. But nevertheless, that story is just in the commentaries, and it doesn't make sense. If you read the Abhidhamma, there's parts of the Abhidhamma which were certainly written in the time of Asoka. You've got the Katawatu, the points of controversy, which was written by Moggaliputta Sisasa, who was the head of the monks during the Third Council at the time of Asoka. That's a given that was written after the time of the Buddha, 200 years afterwards. The Buddha couldn't have taught that, because those events which are recorded in there hadn't happened yet. But also, there's other very, very strong evidence. If ever you read those suttas, at the First Council, that's just after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, when Mahakasapa called all the monks together, 500 arahats, and Upali, recited the Vinaya, he was the expert then, so they all recited it, agreed on it, and decided that that's the Vinaya they would follow. And Ananda recited all the suttas he'd heard, all the Dhamma he'd heard in the five Nikayas. There was no recitation of the Abhidhamma at all. Absolutely not. And that's actually in our tradition, in all traditions actually. But the point was that in some suttas, there's a couple of places they mention the Abhidhamma. And one very telling sutta is called the Gudisari Sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's all about the duties of a forest monk. A monk who stays under the trees, in the jungles, away from everywhere else, meditating. And one of the duties, he said he should be an expert and well-versed in Abhivinaya and Abhidhamma, the two. This is a forest monk. Even more well versed in the Abhivinaya and the Abhidhamma than the ordinary city monks. And that makes it very clear. The Abhivinaya means like the higher discipline. In other words, the more renunciation, the more letting go, the more purity of the conduct of body and speech. Because Abhi just means like a higher. Just the same as a higher Vinaya was not some set of precepts written in another book. In the same way, the Abhidhamma, if it's a forest monk, the forest monks don't get into studies. The original meaning of the Abhidhamma was like the higher understanding of these teachings. And when you start expounding on sojanas or insight in a deeper way, that is the Abhidhamma. It wasn't a collection of books. It was just a general theme, which the forest monks were supposed to know better than anybody else. So that was the original meaning of the Abhidhamma. And if anybody is still uncertain, that one of the books which I still have on my shelf is from Professor A.K. Warder. He was from Cambridge University. He's retired. I think he might be dead now. But he wrote a very wonderful book called Indian Buddhism. And the whole purpose of the book, as a Pali scholar, as a professor, as an Indologist, I think he called himself, he wanted actually to answer that very question. What were the original teachings of the Buddha? And as such, that he forms his methodology, and he goes into this wonderful history of Buddhism, and just how the original suttas, where they came from, how they were added onto, how the next layer of teachings came. And he gives actually a very good description of the development of Buddhism. And he says he's not a Theravada Buddhist, he's not a Mahayana Buddhist, he's a professor. He's just trying to be like a rationalist scholar who is not party to any side, and actually to answer those questions. And he comes out very, very strongly to say the Abhidharma, as we know, is certainly after the time of the Buddha. And his main argument for that is, once Buddhism had it split into many, many different schools, the schools, all different schools of Buddhism, they have a very, very common Vinaya. The rules are basically the same. And even the suttas are basically the same. But what's different is the Abhidharma. And he was actually saying that what was common to each school of Buddhism, when they parted, they would keep carrying their original teachings. But what they added after those splits into different sects, what they added afterwards would always be different. So, from that argument, which is a very coherent argument, he was saying that the Abhidharma certainly was sometime after the time of the Buddha, after the time when Buddhism started to organize itself into different schools. That's the time of the Abhidharma. The wonderful thing about Buddhism is that I can say that without being excommunicated. Because Buddhism, of all these religions, you can say these things, and you can actually argue them, and you can go to the original text, you can think it out for yourself, you can use reason. We don't have any like sacred cows in Buddhism, because the Buddha said from the very, very beginning, if you don't believe it, fine, congratulations, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You have to experience these things for yourself, you have to use reason, as in the Kalama Sutta. Just before he died, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he said, look, if you hear any teachings which are attributed to the Buddha, look them up in the Vinaya or the Suttas, and if they're not there, they're not the teachings of the Buddha. And he actually gave you the permission to reject if you did see it in the original teachings. So the Abhidharma, it's quite useful, it's quite helpful, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's not the original teachings of the Buddha. In the same way that my sort of teachings of the two bad bricks, that's not the teachings of the Buddha. It can be helpful for you, but it's not the original teachings of the Buddha. So when I say that, it's not that I'm rejecting it, it's useless, but I'm saying it's not original. If you want to find that out, go look in the suttas, do your own research. Go look at especially Professor Warder's book, it's an excellent book. He also says even Theravada. Theravada is not the original teachings of the Buddha. Theravada's added a few things on as well. It's the closest. Sometimes the body has the urge of taking a deep breath. Do I control it? Thank you. No, don't control it. Who wants to breathe a deep breath? Okay, body, be kind to it. Just allow it to take a deep breath. Because if you hold on, you don't allow the body, then the time it does take a deep breath, it'll be an even deeper breath. The same time when you have a little cough. When you're meditating, you have a little cough. Don't try and suppress it. Cough as soon as you can. Otherwise, if you suppress it, it's just like Mount Vesuvius. It keeps on building up the energy, until when you do cough, everybody can hear it. It's like a big explosion. And you end up running out there, just coughing, coughing, coughing. So it's best to get it over and done with quickly. So don't try and control and suppress. You control and suppress things, usually what happens, it gets worse afterwards. So if you want to take a long breath, go for it. A friend said after about 10 minutes into her sitting meditation, she had an eerie feeling and her hair stood on end. Then she felt two jolts in her buttocks, like she was lifted up from her cushion. Is this release of energy you mention, or is it the work of some unseen friendly beings? Unfriendly beings. Well, pinching a girl in her buttocks, I think that's a very naughty being anyway, at the very least. I don't know where these questions come from, but if you get eerie feelings and their hair standing on end, it could be so many different things. If it is unseen beings, you just tell them to go and get lost. You have more power than any unseen beings, except the devas, if they come to help you. There's one of my fellow monks, here we go, a few ghost stories. He was staying in this monastery in the north of Thailand, and like many of the forest monasteries, they're also cremation grounds. So when somebody died, they take their body to these monasteries to burn. And so with the body would usually come the ghost, and the ghost would stay there, would hang out in the monasteries. So many of these forest monasteries had heaps and heaps of ghosts. This was a good monk, and he was meditating, and you know what it's like, I mean, each one of you, after a while you get a bit sore, you go back to your room, and you just lean against a wall and just put your feet out to rest. And he did that one day, and he felt someone literally pull his foot, actually tug it, to wake him up. And first of all, he thought it was like a deva, a heavenly being, that comes to say, don't be lazy, monk, carry on meditating. But after a while, whatever it was, kept on coming in. And it was obviously not one of the heavenly beings, it was one of the ghosts in the monastery, just coming to play around with him, to poke him. And it always, after a while, he would actually recognize it's coming in because this really disgusting smell would accompany it. One of the signs of a heavenly being is a beautiful, fragrant smell. One of the signs of a lower being is a like disgusting, like rotting flesh smell. And this is what used to come in. And he would be meditating there, and it would sometimes poke him or jab him, and just playing around. And in the end, he told me this story personally. He said one day the demon came in, or this ghost, whatever it was, and this monk said, right, ghost, you sit down and you meditate and watch your breath, or you get out of here. He was firm, he scolded the ghost. And the ghost went out, he never came back again. And that's actually one of the true things. If you can order a ghost around, just tell him, look, I meditate, this is my retreat, get out. You can do that. And if you do it with firmness, you've got more power, the ghost will go away. Just like being a policeman, you know, the policeman got these air of authorities. They go over there, go over there, you follow them. So you've got more authority, first of all, than the ghost. Number two, it's very, very, very unlikely that any lower being could even come into this hall, simply because, number one, it's a temple, number two, you've all been keeping these precepts, and number three, we've been creating so much good energy here, like loving kindness and sharing merits. My goodness, only the beautiful people, the good people can come in here, the devas, because the devas are always attracted to good people. And the energies of good people, that's actually they keep the negative people out. They just can't come close. Again, there's many stories about that. One of my favourite stories about this is there was this Thai girl who's staying in Perth, a very devoted Buddhist. And her mother, her father had died, and her sisters weren't really looking after her mother in Thailand. So she invited her mother to come and stay in Perth. And you know, she paid for everything. And Lucy really looked after her mum. And when her mother started getting sick, towards her old age, she was put in hospital, and this Thai girl wanted to find out whether her mother was going to survive this illness, or whether she was going to die. So she went to one of the mediums in Perth. Every city's got their mediums. You just paid them $20, and the medium went into a trance. But first of all, the medium wanted to know, what hospital is your mother in? What ward, what room number, what's her name? And then I'll leave my body, and in the astral body, I'll go and find your mother and find out whether she's going to die or not. So he paid the $20, this lady went into a trance, this medium, and went completely unconscious, and about 20 minutes later, 15 minutes later, she came out of her trance. And the first thing she did was to give the $20 back to this Thai girl. And the Thai girl said, what's going on? Could you find her? And the medium said, I could find her. I found her hospital, I found the ward, I found the room, but I couldn't go inside. She said, there was an energy field around your mother. So I've never seen that before. I just can't get close enough to find out whether she's going to survive or not. Who is your mother? And the Thai girl, oh, she's a Mer Chi. That's a Thai nun. She's been a nun keeping the eight precepts for the last 30 years. And at that, the medium got very angry and scolded this Thai girl. Why didn't you tell me beforehand? People like me can't get close to people like that. You've just wasted my time, you stupid Thai girl. But the important part, I laughed when she told me that story because I understood it. If you're even like a medium, you can't get close to good people. Now, when you start keeping precepts, you've got an energy field around you, which is much more powerful than any lower being. So if you're keeping your precepts, well, that friend who's keeping her precepts and a really good person, then there cannot be any a lower being playing around with you. All it can be is just just probably say the energies being released from the body. Oh yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, say you've got a ghost, you've got a mummy ghost and a baby ghost there. You probably died some time ago. You're very compassionate to it. Oh, this one ghost. Where is it? This is one ghost in one of the houses in Perth. And I think it's because the husband, he got fed up with it, so he brought in a Catholic priest to actually exorcise it and all his ceremonies. And that really made the ghost upset. And the ghost got even worse. Because imagine what it's like being a ghost. This is my house as well. Leave me alone. I don't want to go. And so the ghost refused to go. So the Catholic priest, it didn't work. So when we went in there, we just said, oh, look, calm down, ghost. It's okay. And the woman was quite happy to have the ghost around. It wasn't interfering with them. She said, oh, you can stay as well. So the ghost became very happy. You just tell the ghost, look, don't come before 9 o'clock. Okay? The ghost, because they are lower beings, they're just like a little cat or a dog in the house. But you can tell them what to do, you can train them. If you get a well-trained ghost, the ghost can be very helpful for you. They can keep out burglars. It happens. Sometimes, no, this is true, sometimes a burglar's coming in the house, the ghost wakes you up. Or pushes you, so you know there's a burglar coming. Or like a fire in the house, and the ghost will wake you up. Sometimes the ghost can be very protective and caring, if you care for them. So if they don't mind the ghost being around, oh, it's great. Just say, okay, ghost, but you know, these are the rules of the house. One of the most weird ghosts in one of the houses in Perth. It's a really funny story. He likes watching the TV, this ghost. And this family, they're watching the TV, watching some program, say it might be a soccer match, and the ghost doesn't want to watch the soccer, so he changes the channel. And so they get this remote, and they change back to the soccer, whichever they want to watch, and it changes back again a second later. So you know, the ghosts have got their own remote control. They can change it. I think in the end they just got their own, another television just for the ghost. So, guys, you watch that one. We watch this one over here. It's true. It happens. Anyway. Ajahn, we often request monks to conduct a Bodhi Puja to help someone to recover from sickness. How does that work? A Bodhi Puja is just, it's usually called a Buddha Puja, if you're just like doing an offering to the Buddha. And even though the Buddha passed away a long time ago, he actually said, and this is very true, if you make an offering as if it was to the Buddha, because the mind is most important, intention is paramount, you just get exactly the same karma, just about as if the Buddha was still alive. So sometimes you see people giving like apples and oranges and pears to the Buddha statue. It's like an offering to the Buddha. Now the Buddha will never eat that, because the Buddha statues can't eat. But the offering, if you do it with a faithful heart, then actually it's like giving an offering to the Buddha. So you're making merit. You're making good karma. So whenever you make good karma, then you can share it to your deceased relations or other beings. But it doesn't have to be just doing a Buddha puja. One of the highest types of merit, even more meritorious than giving any donations like a puja, is to especially to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. The Buddha said that's so much higher than giving even like billions of ringgit in donations to any monastery. So if you have taken refuge, that's way up there in the really high good karma. Then if you keep the five precepts, that's even more good karma than going for refuge. So imagine what you've been doing. You've been keeping the eight precepts for the last few days. And that is huge good karma. That's even much, much, much bigger than keeping the five precepts or taking refuge. That's worth billions and billions and billions and billions of ringgit in donations. So your karma is like keeping the precepts. It's huge. Sometimes you don't realize it. So you know, you don't need to have done a puja. You've kept the precepts. You've been meditating. Meditating is one of the highest of the good karmas. So you've already made huge merit by what you've been doing here before. That's actually what I meant. I never explained. Just the fact of sitting on your cushion, trying to meditate, that's good enough. You should be so happy and so grateful you just got this opportunity to meditate. Whether you get jhanas or not, that's extra. This by itself is a huge act of merit, of good karma. So you don't need to do a Buddha puja. You've transcended that many, 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 many times over by keeping precepts, going for refuge, and now by meditating. So you don't really need monks for that. I know I'm talking myself out of a job, but I'm very happy to do that. Dear Ajahn, can a person enter jhana within 1 minute? How could one overcome fear over dirtiness? Well, that means. Anyway, can you enter a jhana within 1 minute? Obviously, it depends where you're starting from. If a person has just experienced a jhana, and they're just coming out again, then they can go back again very quickly because they're that close. But if you just come on a retreat for the first time, you've got all of the tiredness, the worldliness, then it's going to take a while before you can get a jhanas, even if you're experienced at it. So the time a person takes to get into a jhana depends on where they're starting from and also their experience. And how to overcome fear over dirtiness. Even like no dirt, that's soil, that's fertilizer. Now things grow in dirt, they never grow in purity. You can't grow a tree in the marble. You need soil, you need dirt, you need sort of dung and rotten stuff. And that's actually what plants grow out of. So overcoming the fear of dirtiness, you understand, yeah, peace grows on cleanliness, but wisdom grows out of dirtiness. So wisdom, if you've got, I see any dirt or any defilements in you, sure it make peace harder, but it make wisdom easier. So any defilements, that you can turn that into fertilizer. Any, I call it dog poo for the mango tree. Any time you make a mistake and do something stupid, it's like you've trodden in the dog poo. But when you trod in the dog poo, say, whoopee! Now I can take that back to my mango tree at home, dig it in, and eventually those mangoes will be sweeter. You had any mangoes today, this morning? You know where all that sweetness came from? So you turn the dog poo into sweetness, or the dirtiness into something beautiful. What is transference of merit? Is it for the living or deceased? If the latter, how can they receive it if there is rebirth? Okay, how it works, the transference of merits. Sometimes, according to some monks, they say you can only transfer it to deceased. I don't think so. You can transfer it to the living as well. And this is how it's done. I think I told a story to someone recently. I remember I read this in the Melbourne Age. There was a prominent veterinary surgeon in Melbourne who told his story. He just finished work on a Friday afternoon and he was going into the countryside about a 2 or 3 hour drive away for a weekend party with his friends. Now he'd finished his work and he was looking forward to a very lovely weekend in a beautiful part of the countryside having a nice party with all of his friends. And halfway on the journey, on the motorway, the freeway somewhere, he was overtaken with this emotion. It was so strong, he didn't know why. He had to pull over the side of the road, and he just started crying uncontrollably. He was weeping, he was crying his eyes out. And he didn't know why. He was a man, and what's going on? But you can't stop these things when they come. So he cried and cried and cried, and after about 10 minutes, when he stopped crying and dried his eyes, and he felt able to drive his car again, he got into the car, and very slowly and carefully drove to the place where the party was. And when he arrived there, there was a message for him. His dog had been run over by a car. Exactly the time when he felt his emotions coming up. Even though his dog, who was obviously very fond of, had been run over at home and he'd been some 100 kilometers away, he could still feel there was something happening, something wrong. He didn't know why or what, but he had this incredible emotion coming up. You understand how we do have a connection with those we grew up with our loved ones. And it's so common, if any of you have a relation, say a son or a daughter who's, say, studying in London, and they have an accident, like a car accident, and they get injured, you will know, even here in Ipoh, you will know that something's wrong. Sometimes you won't be able to put your finger on it, what's wrong. Sometimes you'll feel, something's up with my son. And you just get on your mobile and give them a call, and yeah, they've just been admitted to hospital. And that's so common. How does it happen? What is that connection between loved ones? Don't need to know what it is, but it's there. So if you are thinking of a relation, alive or dead, when you're doing an act of goodness and kindness and generosity, when you want to share merits, you really think of them. You say, these merits are for you. Then, because you're thinking of them, you open up a channel to them, and you can spread and allow those energy, that goodness, that good karma to flow to them, and they do receive it. One of the little exercises which I sometimes do, I do this on the last morning of the retreat, hopefully if I remember. You know when we do the loving kindness meditation in the morning? Sometimes, towards the end of the retreat, I will tell you, right now, think of somebody, someone close to you who's not here, and spread them, zap them with superpower metta. Really get into it. And that being, may you be well and happy, may you be free of suffering. Really get into it. And then I'll look at the time, and I'll note it down. And I'll tell you what that time was when you spread this incredible loving kindness towards that being, that person. And then when you go home, I ask you, give them a call, or if you live with them, just ask them. If you don't mind me asking, what were you doing about, sort of 9 o'clock on that morning? Just ask them that. And you'll be amazed just how well this works. They will say, strange, you should say, that I was thinking about you. I felt so good that morning. Because actually they do receive your metta. And I love to play around with that because I want to prove to people, especially Westerners, that it actually works. In the last retreat, when I did that, at least one lady, she called me afterwards, Ajahn Brahm, it works. Of course it works, I know that. Yeah, but I didn't think it would work. Now she actually spent loving kindness to, I think, her son or whatever. When she got home, she asked him, what are you doing? She said, amazing, Mum, I was thinking about you. I felt so good about you that time. So you don't ask a leading question. You just say, what were you doing? You don't say, what are you thinking about me? Or did you feel happy that day? You don't ask leading questions. Just open questions just to convince you, yourself, that yeah, it does work. So you can do that. It works. So because of that, you can understand how you can transfer your good energy, your good karma, especially to those who are very close to you. It's much harder if they don't know you, but still, with a bit of power, you can do that. Dear Ajahn, since superpower mindfulness could do such wonders, how do we develop it? Just by following the instructions. I've been telling you all week how to develop superpower mindfulness. How you do it? By stop doing things, making the mind very peaceful and still. So all the energy, you've got this energy of your mind, of your being. And too often it just goes off into managing, into doing things, into reacting, into thinking especially. That uses up lots and lots of energy. If you can stop that wastage of energy, then the energy has only got one other place to go. It goes into knowing, into mindfulness. You just have to be patient. After a while, the energy just starts flowing into mindfulness, and your mindfulness gets supercharged. You get superpower mindfulness. It's really good fun. So a few of you have got superpower mindfulness already. So maybe, hopefully, the rest of you will soon. What's this? Okay, you've got sort of a list here, this question. Food, great tasting. Sleep, soundly, sometimes doing meditation. Boredom, nil. Four, removal feeling after sitting. It peace, ease, wanting to smile. Jhana's nil, nimitta's nil. Awareness of breath, not pronounced. I hear dialogue within myself, but I get occasional mini insights. Or I smile, weeping, understanding, acceptance. Where am I in the meditation? You are here. You've arrived. You're always arriving. But how many people have arrived? So just be here. It does not matter, sort of, all these descriptions. Just be here and be with whatever you're doing. Just send me the lotus. Any old lotus will do. Just stay with it. Whatever lotus you happen to be with, it might be the most dirty, unpromising, small, sickly looking lotus, but every lotus has got this incredible jewel in the heart of it. So this moment now is enough to get the jhanas, enlightenment, everything. You just need to focus on this, be with this, don't go anywhere, don't do anything, just allow the awareness to open up the lotus without moving, without doing anything. If you do something, you stop it opening. If you're at peace, you're still, the sun is still on the lotus, still on these leaves, everything happens by itself. It's an incredible thing with meditation. Once you understand what I'm talking about there, you can start with anything, any state of mind, any place. You can even be the most noisiest, smelliest, most uncomfortable place. You just go into the center of it. And this terrible lotus on the outside is all dusty and dirty. It starts to open out. In the middle of the most unpromising lotuses, the most beautiful, wonderful states of mind. So don't go anywhere. Be more fully where you are. Don't try and go on to something else. Go deeper into where you are. No time, just now. Imagine, sometimes after chanting I will ask forgiveness and guidance from the Buddha, and my prayers have been answered. You aligned? Happily, I shared this to my friend, but he answered, how can I ask guidance from the Buddha when he doesn't exist anymore? Then, who answered my prayers? Confused, please advise. Okay. He who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. She who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Does the Buddha exist? Does the Dhamma exist? If the Dhamma exists, the Buddha exists. But this is not the being a person. This is just the truth, awakening, the potential. So this is because that you've asked. You haven't asked another being. You just asked the Buddha within you, the enlightenment, the Dhamma, the truth. And because you've made an aspiration. Aspirations are just ways of turning the mind into a certain direction. And those aspirations very often work. So, next meditation, ask the Buddha for peace. Ask the Buddha for stillness. Ask the Buddha for nimitta. In other words, just aspire. But know which way you have to go to reach those goals. Go in. So this is one's intention. But know where to find the goal. Right inside this moment. Next question. After meditating for about 2 hours, my wrists and hands and fingers swelled. It is not imaginary because I could not wear my wristwatch immediately after that. The swell may have subsided 30 minutes later. I'm not sure when because I went to bed. Why is this so? It must be just your blood needs to go down to your wrist for some reason or another. Leave it alone. It won't swell that much. And if they swell a little bit, then they'll go down again afterwards. The body knows how to look after itself. It's just probably some little circulation problems, that's all. Just leave it alone. Don't worry about it. And it all turned out well in the end. And it's great. Maybe that was actually a teaching to throw away your wristwatch and stop looking at the time. So you just meditate, who cares? Dear Ajahn, can't explain the difference between chanda, aspiration, and dhanha, attachment. During meditation practice, do we let go everything, including aspiration and all wholesome wishes, desires? Craving is always trying to get somewhere and do something or achieve something or gain something. It's a wanting, it's a grasping. And the chanda can be either. The chanda can be the intention to actually to grasp something or the intention to let go. So if it is the intention to let go, to abandon, to be still, to stop controlling, to stop doing things, just to watch, just to listen, to feel, to know, not to try and get somewhere. If it's that type of aspiration, it leads to nirvana. If it's the aspiration which is trying to accumulate things, accumulate sort of jhanas, spiritual points, I want more insights than my best friend, we're on a competition, who gets the best insights after the retreat. What meditation did you get into? First jhana, that's nothing, I got into second. So don't get into that sort of stuff, because that is craving. If it's an aspiration, that may my best friend become enlightened before me, may she get into jhanas, may her meditation just really take off. That's like selflessness, that's letting go. If you do things like that, then you get into jhanas before she does. Because you've got a beautiful mind, it's letting go, giving up, renouncing. As Ajahn Chah kept on saying, you don't meditate to get something. You meditate to give up things. To renounce. So see how much you can give up in your meditation. How much you can abandon. Aspire to giving up. Aspire to expire. Anyway, Adam. Dear Ajahn, why do we bow 3 times to the Buddha image in the monks? What is sharing the merits? And why do yogis not eat after midday? Why do we bow 3 times to the Buddha image in the monks? If you don't bow to the image or to the monks, you bow to what they represent, what they mean. So when I bow down to a Buddha statue, I bow down to virtue, peace and compassion. First time I bow down to virtue, because virtue is really important to me. I love virtue, I respect virtue, I worship virtue. And the Buddha, to me, represents this incredible virtue. He never got angry at anybody. He was never an angry being. He was always kind and forgiving. And I respect peace. Especially the peace of meditation, the deep stillness of the mind. I worship that peace. So when I bow down the second time, I bow down to peace. And the third time, I bow down to this double thing, wisdom and compassion. Because I love wisdom, I just get so inspired by compassion, by kindness, by metta. So that's the third thing which I bow down to. Because I bow down to those things, psychologically it means those things become ever more important to me. Whatever I worship, I tend to imitate. In the same way, as a young man, I used to worship the musician Jimi Hendrix. And I actually had a hairstyle like his. I don't know if you can imagine that, because I've got a bald head now. I had the hair out to here somewhere. Because I worshipped him, I tried to imitate him. Now I worship the Buddha, so I've got the Buddha's hairstyle. I imitate. And so it's whatever you worship, you tend to imitate. So if you do worship virtue, peace and compassion, you start to imitate virtue, peace and compassion. It becomes a great way of enhancing your spiritual practice. So that's why we bow down. That's the same way we bow down to a monk. Because what that monk represents for us, the qualities which you really respect in that monk or that nun, you bow down. You remember those qualities, and it means you'll try and imitate those qualities in the future. So you never bow down to a person, you bow down to what it represents. And that's why about a year ago, I gave a talk in a Christian school, in one of these Christian private schools in Perth. It was an Anglican school. And as I went in, so it was at the morning assembly. As I went into the morning assembly, there was the chaplain, and there was the headmaster, the principal, and myself. And the principal turned to me and said, "Look, it's a Christian school. We've got a little shrine in there. You don't need to bow to the shrine." And I said, "Why not? I demand my rights to bow to the Christian shrine." I overdid it a bit, but I wanted to make a point. He said, "How can you bow to a Christian shrine? I can see something in there which I respect. And I'm going to bow down to what I respect in that Christian shrine. I'm not bowing down to Jesus Christ. I'm a Buddhist. But I can bow down to some compassion, to some peace which I see there." And so that's what I did. And that's a beautiful thing, how when any religion, in any icon of religion, you can always find something in there which is beautiful, something of a virtue in there which you can respect, and bow down to that. And I'm not worshipping Jesus, I was worshipping something in there which I could see, some compassion, some forgiveness. It's very easy then to bow down to something you respect. That's what we do. The same way in like Sri Lanka, I don't think it's a Chinese tradition, but certainly Sri Lanka, you bow down to your parents. You worship your parents. And sometimes the Sri Lankan children do that every day. And why do they do that? Sometimes their parents are quite mean and they don't love their kids that well. But it doesn't matter, you bow down to the whole idea of parenthood. What being a parent represents. Like two people are nurturing and caring for a young one who can't look after themselves, is sacrificing themselves for somebody else. So you can actually worship that. And when you worship that selflessness and care and looking after and nurturing, it's a beautiful thing to worship. It means these wonderful qualities in our societies become strengthened. So that's what we do. And he also asks, what is the sharing of merits? I think I've mentioned that already. All the good karma you've done, you give it away to somebody else. And never think that you have nothing left. The more you give away, the more you get back. So if you make sort of heaps and heaps, like a whole truckload of merit, and you give that away to someone else, you get two truckloads back in return. So it's small investment, great returns. And why do yogis not eat after midday? It's because the most yogis are already too fat. So the one that's just actually simplicity. They don't have to worry about eating. It just takes up too much time. It's okay here because you just go down and the food's on the table. Or on the table you just have to choose it and eat it and just it's so quick. But just cooking food, how much time does that take? All you girls who have husbands, how much time does it take, cooking? You've got to go to the shops, you've got to get the food, you've got to clean the veggies, you've got to dice them up, you've got to start the stove or start cooking. And it takes hours to cook. And sometimes these men, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and it's all finished. They don't realise how many hours it took to cook that stuff. So why do you have to do that 3 or 4 times a day? Wouldn't it be much easier just cook everything all in one go in the morning and stop it in one bowl for your husband and say, "Here you are, this is lasting you for the day." It's surefire method for divorce. But the point is, here in the retreat is simplicity. So just keep it 2 meals a day. In the afternoon, you don't have anything to do. And it's also, once you get used to it, it doesn't take all that long to get used to it. You find your stomach is empty, and it's much easier to meditate. You don't feel so sleepy. Because whenever you eat, all the blood has to go to the stomach to actually digest the food. So here, it's great because, you know, all the food, no food there to digest, all the blood can go to your brain and get in these nice meditations. Ajahn, what should I do when evil thoughts arrive? How should I apologize? It's easy. Ah, evil thoughts. Never mind. It's okay. So be kind to your evil thoughts. If you actually smile at the devil and say, ah, there, devil, poor thing, no one likes you, but I'm going to like you. Then straight away, any devil or demon, they can't stand that. Either they run away or they completely change and metamorphose into your friend. It's actually what we add on to what we're watching makes it a demon or an angel. So if you have an evil thought arise, oh look, never mind, you're not perfect yet. So don't add evil thoughts to the evil thoughts. Say, ah, I don't want this to happen. Ah, why me? This is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. Ah. Don't make a big fuss and bother about it. It's just an evil thought. Just where does it come from? Who cares? So just be kind to it. When you're kind to the evil thoughts just vanish. I remember I was in Java in February, and obviously I went to Borobudur, and there was one of the stone carvings there from the Jataka stories. It's just a beautiful little story. There was this man. He was a merchant, went travelling, made fortunes, lost fortunes. But one day when he was down, he was at home, and he got irritated and he pushed his mother over and she fell and hit herself. That's supposed to be really bad karma, just pushing over your mother. So when he died, he went to this special hell realm where people could push over their mothers. And there he met this man, and he was in agony, because he had this wheel which was turning with razors cutting into his head, into his brain. And this man sort of said, I've been here for 600 years enduring this agony of this wheel cutting remorselessly into my brain with no let up from the pain. And I had to endure this punishment because I pushed over my mother and she hit herself. And that's my punishment. But I was told 600 years ago that in 600 years' time another man will come who also pushed over his mother. And when he comes, the wheel will go from my head into his. Now you've come. And immediately the wheel lifted from his head and he was free of pain. And he went to this new man who just pushed his mother over and started cutting in his agonizing pain. And he was about to enjoy it for another 600 years. But this man's thoughts, it's a terrible thing to push over your mother. I'm very, very remorseful. I shouldn't have done that. But out of compassion, if any other people push over their mothers, I will take their karma. Let this wheel cut into my brain for 600,000 years. And I will take all the karma from those 1,000 people who pushed over their mothers and would have to endure this. And with that feeling of like, not thinking of himself but thinking about others, with that sense of sacrifice, the willing to take on that pain of 1,000 other miscreants, immediately the wheel shattered and he got reborn in the heaven realm. He didn't need to endure that punishment anymore, simply because of his forgiveness and his remorse and his high state of mind. It's the mind which is the forerunner of all things and is the most powerful. So any demon in front of you, you just change your mind state from fear into kindness, and you change that demon into an angel. Even the ugliest of demons, ah, never mind, poor thief, no one likes you, the door of my heart's even open to you, little demon. You may have no friends because you look so ugly and you're so smelly and offensive, but you could be my friend. Come on. With that degree of kindness, the demon becomes an angel. So the power, transforming power of loving kindness is great. prayers. I have yet to see Buddhists say utter prayers. Instead, they recite Pali chanting. Any reason for this? Prayer is in a language we all understand, seems to be in a more meaningful rather than reciting by heart what is foreign to us, which does not come from what our heart feels like telling. Why is it so? That we have started doing the chanting in English, like we do the metta chant in English every morning. One of these days we'll get some nice translations for the other chants as well. So if you can chant it in your local language, that is the best. So you understand what you're chanting. But it's not a prayer in the sense of asking for something. It's just a recitation to bring one faith. Like we do the chant for loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Let them be humble and not conceited, unburdened with duties, don't do so much, contented and easily satisfied. Some beautiful teachings in that. Be easily satisfied with your meditation. Don't ask for too much. If you're asking for too much, you demand so much in this meditation retreat, you will get nothing. If you're just so content, I don't care what happens, then you get everything. So be contented and easily satisfied. And also with your life. Be contented and easily satisfied with your wife. She may not be the best, but she's good enough. Be easily and contented with your husband. You may be, well, you know what husbands are like, but they're all the same. Because women have told me about their husbands, and I've got a lot of information about what husbands are like. And if you think, if you change this one and get another one, you get something different, you get exactly the same. It's just all the same model, basically. So, be contented and easily satisfied. I felt tension at head, neck and back as whole, and it swung me forward and backwards furiously for a whole day yesterday. I woke up this morning and developed a headache. This was the same with my meditation 2 weeks ago. Should I hold back the swing of motion or what should I do? May you be well and happy. May you be well and happy too. You've got a swinging meditator. Okay, if it is causing you a problem, just change your posture. Don't sit meditation for too long. Do more walking meditation. So whoever asked that question, if you do more walking meditation, you find that just whatever's in your body, any blockages, the walking, you're moving the body, the muscles are moving, it's liable to be released. So do more walking meditation, then come back and sit. You find you're probably more comfortable. It's actually interesting, if you do too much sitting meditation and your mind isn't peaceful, sometimes the balance of energies in the body can sometimes go out of kilter. So do walking meditation, it's great because the body is moving. And when you're moving, sort of, you know, the muscles are moving, the blood is pumping around, and sometimes if there is any blockages, it can be moved by doing the walking meditation. So the answer to that one, I'd do more walking meditation today. Ajahn, do you feel disappointed, a waste of time, when yogis make little improvements? Can Ajahn explain Bardo's state in detail, how to deal with it, and should we inform our old family members? Thanks, Suki Hota. Do I feel disappointed, a waste of time, when yogis make no improvement? Some of you have been coming to my meditation retreats for so many times. How many times have you been listening to the same instructions? Haven't you understood? No, of course you don't get so disappointed. You only get disappointed if you have expectations. I don't expect anything out of you. I don't expect anything, you don't get disappointed. No, because you know what it's like. You know, so a teacher is just like a parent. You know, you've got kids, and sometimes, you know, it takes them a long time to get to understand mathematics or understand just, you know, how to wash the dishes. You be patient with them, and the more patient, you encourage them, and they get better and better at it. I don't get disappointed when people make little improvement, but I get really inspired when somebody does make improvement. So the disappointment, I give that one away. The inspiration, I keep that. So when somebody comes along and says they've got, you know, deep meditation, or they've seen some great insight, I enjoy that with you. That gives me a lot of happiness when somebody gets a jhana for the first time. That's one of my great joys of my monastic life. Somebody comes along and says, "Oh, I've got this jhana." Or they get even nimittas and the mind starts getting peaceful. That gives me so much happiness. But if it doesn't happen, I won't get disappointed. And a bad state. What happens to you when you die? So we'll wait until that, until you die, and then I can explain it to you. Because there's not much time. Bardo state, when you die. Maybe I'll talk about that during the sections on insight meditation, which comes in a couple of days. How does one know if one has become a sotapan? Thank you, Ajahn. That's coming in a couple of days too. So when I talk about enlightenment, how do you know when you're enlightened or not? Thing is, it's very, sometimes it's hard to know you are enlightened, but it's easy to know you're not enlightened. Will I encounter pain in my legs during walking meditation? Should I watch the pain until the pain goes away, or should I ignore the pain and just watch the breath? If I was you, you're getting painful in walking meditation, you're probably walking too much. Go and sit down. It's much better. So, if it's not really a pain, but some sort of irritation, you can just watch the irritation, just allow it to disappear, relax with it. But if it really is pain, it must mean you're just doing too much. So stop the walking meditation, just go and sit down. And if both are painful, go and lie down, have a rest. And if both resting is painful, lying down is painful, sitting is painful, and walking meditation is painful, there's not much hope. I don't know what to do next. Mother should be okay. It is said, a healthy body supports a healthy mind. I personally find it, the mind becomes more alert after workout exercise. The Shaolin monks have extreme exercise, i.e. Kung Fu meditation. What did Buddha say about using exercise to complement advanced meditation? Why not include some physical exercises in your retreat? Okay. Very often, sometimes the physical exercises can be a bit, again, too extreme, too disturbing. Usually most people are in reasonably good health. You don't need to be fully fit to become, get into jhanas, get enlightened. Otherwise, sometimes there are people who are old and sick, they think, oh, there's no chance for me. Sometimes people ask that, look, I'm in a wheelchair. I've got diabetes, or I've got chronic indigestion, or I've got this disease, that disease. Can I still meditate? Of course you can. And it's actually very good for you, good for your body. So even like old and sick people, or monks with coughs, you can still meditate. So the point is, it's just you work with what you've got. If you want to do some exercise, that's fine. Especially if you find the exercise enhances your meditation. It doesn't work for all people. If you find exercise enhances your meditation, then do some exercise. Sometimes on my retreat, some people ask if they can go jogging in the morning. I say, fine, go off and jog for half an hour now. Sometimes people here do Tai Chi. That's fine, do some exercises. But if you don't feel like doing it, you don't have to do it. As far as the Buddha was concerned, that because he would be always walking from place to place, walking on arms round, that itself was a perfect exercise for him. I know that some doctors are saying to me that walking is one of the best types of exercise, much better than jogging or running, because it's a gentle exercise. So walking is a good exercise, and walking meditation is a good exercise for you. But it's also a very calming exercise. So if we go into exercise, after a while we'd be playing tennis and playing soccer and playing all sorts of stuff, thinking it's exercise. Sometimes the exercise is not really for exercise's sake, not for making it fit, it just takes off a life on its own. So, you can do exercise if you want to, but no soccer matches. We can't have the boys versus the girls in soccer. So you want to do exercise, do some Tai Chi, whatever you wish to do, but do it sort of quietly, silently. Don't do push-ups at 4 o'clock in the morning in your dormitory next to everyone else, and waking everybody up. Find a nice quiet place so it doesn't disturb anyone else. It's true that a healthy body supports a healthy mind, but you can have a healthy mind without a healthy body. And a healthy mind is the most important. Okay, that's all the questions answered today. So that anyone wants to put some new ones in for tomorrow, please do so. And if for one reason or another I didn't understand your question properly and I didn't answer it to your satisfaction, please write it again. That's one of my determinations. When I saw some teachers, when they were asked a good question and they didn't really give an accurate answer, either because they didn't know or they made fun of the questioner, that really upset me. And I made a determination that if ever I become a teacher and people ask me a question, I will try my best to answer their question to their satisfaction. And if I don't know the answer, I'll say, I don't know the answer, but I will never try. You ask me one question, I give an answer about something different. That's not fair. So if any question here I haven't answered properly, I apologize, I tried my best, ask it again. So by coming in interviews or putting it in the box. Okay, so now there's a chance for some more meditation. As the days of the retreat advance, so too does your mindfulness. You're settling in now. You get used to the place, you're getting some understanding of what meditation is. So these days, the middle part of the retreat, should be the best. But remember the advice. Always in the present moment. Don't worry about the time. It's time to sit in this moment. It's time to walk. If you want to rest, take a rest. Don't try and get anywhere. Just be in the moment. See how much you can give away. No expectation, contentment, peace. And then you'll find in the most unpromising situations, you'll find incredibly deep peace and super mindfulness. You get so peaceful and so happy. And if you're getting happy and peaceful, don't worry about lunch. I know that one person's already missed their lunch. It's very, very good news. It shows that they're so happy, they'd rather carry on meditating than have lunch. See if you can do the same. You get so happy, so peaceful, so nice, that you're not interested in eating. Isn't that wonderful? See if that can be you. You don't go hungry, because the joy, the happiness of the heart feeds the hunger, and you don't even want to eat. See if you can get into those deep and peaceful meditations. Okay? Best of luck.